Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello, welcome to episode 7 of the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I am your host, Peter McCormack, and with this podcast, I try to meet and interview some of the leading people working in the blockchain and crypto space. And this week, I am really excited to bring you an interview with Laura Shin, who is the host of the Unchained podcast, which is without doubt my personal favorite podcast in the whole space. If you don't know it, you should definitely check it out, especially her interview with Naval Ravikant, which I think I've listened to on probably 4 occasions now. She has been a massive inspiration to me, and I'm really grateful to her for agreeing to do this. And actually, when we did the podcast, before we started recording, she gave me a whole bunch of tips on how to improve my podcast. And I will admit, I was pretty nervous interviewing Laura. You know, she's been working this space for a number of years now. She's interviewed pretty much anyone who's achieved anything in space. She has a really deep knowledge of Bitcoin and crypto. And when I was preparing my questions, I was pretty nervous thinking they might not be technical enough or might not be challenging enough. But it didn't really matter because it was quite a free-flowing conversation and she answered everything in detail. And yeah, you know, I just really enjoyed it. As ever, listen, if you want to support the show, I do this every week, but it really does help. There's a whole bunch of things you can do. You can drop me a review on iTunes, a 5-star review, but only if you think it deserves it. But it helps with getting up in the rankings. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Medium, and I'm on Steam. My handle on each one is at WhatBitcoinDid. If you want, you can check out the website. I also have a newsletter. The website is at www.whatbitcoindid.com. You can sign up for the newsletter there. And I also write a whole bunch of blog posts. And you can also share this out with any of your friends on social media. So let's move on to the interview with Laura. I do hope you enjoy this. If you have any questions afterwards, do feel free to get in touch. I do try and respond to everyone I possibly can. And please also do go and check out both of Laura's podcasts. I mentioned Unchained, but she also has a new one called Unconfirmed. They are both excellent podcasts. Okay, hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Laura. Thank you for agreeing to do this interview with me. I feel a little bit like a young Skywalker with Obi-Wan Kenobi. I've been listening to your podcast for a while. I really wanted to come and meet you and talk to you because you've met so many people and you appear to have quite a broad knowledge in crypto. So thank you. So you've left Forbes now and you're going out on your own. Can you tell me about that? What's happened?
Yeah, so I was freelancing for Forbes for quite a long time, for more than 4 years. And when was it? I think it was 2 years into that is when I fell down the crypto rabbit hole and only wanted to write about that. But I had been covering personal finance for them, which is super, super boring. Once you learn about it, it's like there's not much else new to learn. And so this was back in 2015 when that just wasn't a popular topic. Like nobody was interested, you know, like blockchain was just starting to be a thing at big banks, but, you know, the Bitcoin price was super low and it just was not anywhere near, you know, the kind of space where that it is now, where there's a ton of traction. So, I kind of kept bugging them about it. And they were kind of like happy to let me pursue my passion within certain bounds, but you know, they're a publication. They want like eyeballs on their stories. And so, definitely there was for a little while, like, a more hesitation around letting me write about this in a big way. But then last year when it really started taking off, a whole bunch of things happened. I had like all these offers too. And I think that was, you know, when they sort of woke up and they were like, oh, like,
we don't want to lose you.
Yeah. So I joined full time. But you know, the space moves super, super fast. And so at some point in January, everything happened like in a very short, it was literally within like a 24 or 36 hour period where a couple of things happened that really opened my eyes to the fact that now I suddenly had a lot more competition in the space as a journalist, and that a bunch of writers that had never written about this before were writing about it in a much bigger way. And I felt like, oh, I have this advantage now. I have this head start, but like, it's very quickly going to be eroded. And for various reasons, I actually didn't feel like I was going to be able to maintain that advantage if I stayed in the job. And during the same like 24 or 36 hour period, I own my original podcast, Unchained. And I began to realize, like, with the way the downloads had gone through the roof, that that could be a way for me to support myself and then use some of the extra time to get ahead on my career. So I like made this plan, and I have sort of like a plan A and a plan B for my career. You know, it's so new right now, so I don't want to talk too much about what those plans are. And also I've spent a lot of the time, I mean, it's only been 2 weeks since I left Forbes, so, or 2.5 weeks. So, you know, it's been like, you know, I launched a new podcast, and I've been hiring some people to help me in the background for various reasons. You know, obviously now I'm selling a lot more sponsorships. So I got someone just in the last couple of days actually to do that for me. So there's been a lot of activity, and I've only made a little bit of headway on some of my bigger goals around my writing, but I do think eventually I will have a lot more time for that. And so, yeah, I'm super excited to do that.
So you intend to keep writing as well?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I mean, now people think of me as a podcaster, which is a little bit weird because I have only done 40 some podcasts in my life, but I've done probably at least 1,000 articles, if not more than that.
Right.
So, and writing is my favorite thing. Like when I do the podcast, I'm kind of nervous and it's, I just don't feel like I'm in my element. But when I do when I write, you know, I just get in the zone. I can get lost in that. So
is that because when you're writing, you're on your own, you can pause, you can take time over it. Whereas when you're doing a podcast, you're interviewing somebody and you have to keep that rapport going.
Maybe. I mean, I think it's more that, like with the writing, you can be somewhat perfectionistic. And if you realize that there's a fact you didn't find out that you need, you can always go back and get it. There's so many times now when I listen to the podcast where I'm like, oh shoot, I forgot to ask them that question. Or, oh man, they said that one thing and I wish I had like followed up in that moment. Or, you know, you cannot make it perfect. That's the thing. I mean, maybe if I were doing a different style of podcast, I could, but like, you know, I'm doing these Q&A style interviews. So like the way that I do them is just prep as much as I can beforehand. And there are a few where like, especially even now, I realize that I'm doing them weekly. Like, it's just, if you, like I said, if you forget to ask something, like you can't go back, you know? So.
Well, it's like you said before we started recording that you have a bunch of questions, but you're trying to manage listening and reply to the responses, but also keep track of where they are. And I'm already looking at mine thinking, well, you've jumped into some bits I was going to ask later already.
Right.
So for example, I started having a look at, because I was trying to understand your journey from, I looked at your LinkedIn and I saw your degree at Stanford. And then I saw you did a journalism at Columbus, right?
Columbia.
And then you started writing about finance. And I started to think, okay, well, that was a natural move, finance and tech into crypto. But it wasn't until, I think, was your first crypto article the one in March 14, the newly revealed, could Satoshi Nakamoto worth 400 million Bitcoin be in danger? That was the first one I could find.
That was the first one from Forbes.
Yes,
there was another one I'd written on a site that like now is defunct, I think.
Okay. How did that article come about amongst the finance articles? Because that was a change from what you were writing about.
That one, so even though technically my beat was personal finance, I really just, you know, kind of like I said it before we start recording, but I don't like writing about stuff that I kind of already know or the stuff I've already written about. I only really like writing about something if it's something where I'm learning or like it's something new or, and so when, I think what I did back then, yeah, I remember this. Even though I was supposed to technically write about personal finance, I basically used to write about anything regarding money whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Just, I wrote about like minimum wage. I guess that is personal finance. I wrote about, Occupy Wall Street. I literally just anything that had to do with money whatsoever, I would try to write about in some way. And Bitcoin is money, obviously. And so when Newsweek thought it had revealed who Satoshi Nakamoto was, I was like, oh, that's money related. Like, how could I spin this in a way where I can write about it? And so I think I wrote like, you know, an article on whether or not he really could be in physical danger, as people were saying. And that was, you know, I literally wrote that article in like an hour or two. I somehow come across Jerry Brito before. I don't remember where. And I knew that he was like a knowledgeable person in the space. And so I was like, okay, he's a good source. He's going to be like someone who's going to say something smart. And so I remember I interviewed him. I don't remember if I quoted anybody else, but like, you know, I just did like enough research to write something and just catch the news wave and write something that people who might be Googling about Satoshi Nakamoto might, you know, want to read.
And interestingly, the article says he could be worth $400 million. I looked this morning, and now it's $19.4 billion.
Right. Well, did you hear about the lawsuit yesterday?
With fake Satoshi, Craig Wright.
Yeah. Well, it depends on how you want to describe him, but Craig Wright and Dave Kleiman, yes.
Yeah, I don't feel it's going to be very good for Craig. I think ever since he's come out, I've never been convinced in any way that he is Satoshi. But do you have enough thought on it?
I don't know, because those emails that he was sending before the white paper came out, like, I've never looked myself at them, but I kind of wonder, like, oh, is that something that could be doctor? I don't know. It's not something I've looked into closely at all.
No.
But just knowing that he was writing about Bitcoin before then, like, makes me wonder, you know, because he was calling it even like he was toying around with names, but one of them was
Bitcoin.
He had
multiple names for it, didn't he? Like, he was trying different things. I think it'd be interesting to see how it pans out.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I literally, last night and this morning, so I fell asleep reading the lawsuit, and then this morning I promptly finished it when I woke up, so...
So after that, so moving back to your crypto move into crypto, I noticed it seemed to be the tipping point was around September 15. So I went through the archive of Forbes, and there was suddenly a whole bunch of articles about Bitcoin. There seemed to be some transition. That month there was maybe five, and then I've looked, and that's when the transition seemed to happen. What was it that hooked you with crypto yourself?
So actually the transition happened earlier, but when you write a magazine article, there's like a long time between when you're working on it and when it actually comes out. And that article was actually supposed to come out in the August issue.
Okay.
But it got held for various reasons. And then during that time period of like 3 weeks between the two issues, Nathaniel Popper of the New York Times wrote an article in the New York Times on the same topic. And I was like,
no.
But this wasn't anywhere near as in-depth as my magazine story was. So we were all like, okay. But then they were like, okay, we need to do it now. So I'd been working on that since like, I think June or something. And, so basically what happens is like, if it was going to come out in the August issue, then you need to finish it by like sometime in July. Right. So I started it in June, and I really started falling down the rabbit hole in May of 2015. So, the reason for that was when I had mentioned to my editors that I was bored covering personal finance, that was in the summer of 2014. And they told me I could not switch topics, and I was super bummed out and didn't know what to do with myself. And then that winter, they were like, well, we had this idea to do a Forbes FinTech 50 list. Would you want to be one of the lead reporters on it? So this other reporter and I divvied up the list, and we each took a category, and I took the category of digital currencies.
Okay.
And it was from that point that I've been completely obsessed and like never wanted to write anything about anything else ever again. So I've been doing that as much as I can. And then, like I said, last summer, I finally managed to convince Forbes to let me do it full time. So
was there something specific about it that gripped you though?
Oh, I mean, just the ability to change the world and just understanding that this was a way to upend kind of all the various methods we have for building societal trust, which is kind of, it's very profound, you know, like you don't, and like using technology of all things to do that, like it's kind of a, I don't know, it's just like a, it's just something your mind keeps trying to understand all of it. And I feel like every time I think about it kind of a lot and I think about the different applications, it's almost like my mind is like travel, like literally like, you know, when you go to a foreign country and you travel and you don't have an agenda, but you just sort of wander the streets. Like, it's a little bit like that, but you're doing that like on an intellectual level, and it's like really fun, and like, and you can just do it forever. And there's no, you know, I mean, granted, we'll see how it plays out. Maybe 10 years from now, when like the first chapter of all this is written, and I'm going to be like, oh, like now we know how it's going to play out. Like, I'm not interested anymore. I don't know. But like for now, where, you know, there are so many questions about how should we do it? What are the effects of those things? Like there was like 5 million scenarios a day, like you could just think of, you know, by trying to figure out where this is all going to go.
It seems like a lot of people are looking at it from two specific lenses, which is finance and tech. But also there is a movement of people looking at it more in terms of societal change, like you've kind of mentioned there. And I've seen before you talk about the blockchain has the potential to destabilize governments. So are you seeing this beyond finance and tech and as a way to achieve some kind of changes in society?
So I wouldn't phrase it in that way where it sounds like that's a goal, but I think it's definitely possible, right? I mean, you're already seeing like the IRS is making these moves where they're a little bit more concerned about people not paying taxes on this new form of money. We've also obviously seen regulators in places like China that have cracked down in a big way. They really see it. They must see it as a threat to their government, right? Or at least to the control of, to their control over the money flows in their country. And so, I certainly think that just on a basic level, it definitely threatens governments, but on a more fundamental level, and this is only once the tech is really built out. People are talking about it already. You know, you can use blockchains for things like land titles and for birth certificates and for identity and for voting systems. And these are all governmental functions, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I had a really far out conversation with this guy at Coinbase who's a lawyer and a coder. And at some point he said something like, oh, like hundreds of years from now, people may rule themselves by blockchains. And that's, I think, then when we get to the full-on sort of like video gamification of our lives, where, because like, I feel like that is one effect of blockchains. Like if they sort of do manifest the way some people are talking about, like, you know, you can be incentivized for doing certain things the way like in a game, you know, you can get to the next level or, you know, I mean, I don't play video games, so I don't know how they all function, but, it is, yeah, it's like that thing where you can earn points for doing certain things or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about this on a basic level with things like Filecoin or, you know, what's another one? Like Gollum or, you know, like you offer a service and then you earn these tokens. So I think once these systems kind of manage more aspects of our lives, you know, especially the governmental ones that I mentioned, who knows, like it could be something that is destabilizing to governments now. I don't know. But on the flip side, what I will say is that obviously one concern that we're seeing now is that cryptocurrencies are empowering bad actor governments, right? Like Venezuela or North Korea or Iran. So who knows? I mean, it could be the opposite. Like maybe we're all idealistic and we're like, oh, someday like all our governance will be transparent and there will be no ruler. It'll be decentralized and like blah, blah, blah. And instead, maybe it like will strengthen dictatorships or something. I have no idea. I'm just...
What did you make of the Venezuelan petro crypto dollar on...
Oh, well, I think the big lesson I learned from that is that I should caveat this because I was about to say that decentralization is an important feature to people. But then it's funny because on Twitter the other day, Jill Carlson and Meltem Demirs, Jill Carlson is like a blockchain consultant. She used to work at Chain and she does stuff with Tezos and stuff.
Is this where Fluffy Pony called Highlander?
No, I don't know that part.
Yeah.
No, but they were like making fun of terms that people in the space bandy about that like she wrote these terms grind my gears. And one of them was decentralization. And I was like, what? I was like, I think decentralization is a thing and is important. And what were some of the ones that Meltem? I don't know. It was like this funny thing where I was like, wait, what's wrong with that? Oh, they both were against crypto economics. And I was like, no, that's a thing.
Yeah, you can't be against that. That my last two podcasts have been discussing that.
I think it's, Jill was like, it's just economics. And I was like, no. It's, you know, what I mentioned to you about this video game aspect. I think, you know, when you create this sort of mini economy with a token, that to my mind, that's crypto economics.
So I, my last interview was with Jamie Burke from Outlier Ventures. I know you're connected with him on LinkedIn, but I don't know if you know him.
I've never met him in person, but I've interviewed him.
Right. Okay. So, you know, they have a head of crypto economics within their fund. And what he's saying is that a lot of these utility tokens will have zero value because nobody has built these companies on any kind of economic reality. And this is something they've been focusing on. So I don't know how you could not consider crypto economics something.
Oh yeah, no, I think it's so important because, you know, people only want to buy tokens that will, you know, appreciate in value. And so if you create one that doesn't function properly, then it, you know, people are going to be angry and they're going to want to leave your network. And so I think it's actually incredibly important to think about. But what's interesting is that right now there are so many different ways for evaluating these and for coming up with models for them. And so I know, like, Chris Bernisky came on my podcast and talked about using MV equals PQ to determine kind of like what the price of a token should be. And already this week, I've seen like a couple of other posts responding to that. So, you know, all of this is not set in stone by any means, but I feel like there's a lot of smart thinking going into it about, you know, should you try to incentivize a certain percentage of people in your economy to stake tokens to keep the price up? And, you know, but how do you also foster like enough velocity so people aren't just hodling all the time and like mm-hmm. it doesn't move? These are real questions. And yeah, like anybody who can design a system that really works and really does get a lot of traction, like kudos to them, because I'm just like, whoa, like that seems so hard. I'm glad it's not my job.
Well, I've read his book, and when I started reading the bit about crypto valuation, I honestly got lost.
Really?
I found it myself really hard to understand. But I also think in the industry, there's a lot of people who really don't understand what they're investing in. Just before I came in, I sat in my car and there was a tweet from an account that has 70,000 followers, who they were saying that they see tokens, utility tokens, as similar to owning a share within a company, which is obviously completely wrong.
If you get the decentralization aspect right, it should be wrong.
Yeah, it should be wrong. So I just want to go back to the petrodollar part as well, because in last week, we've also had Iran announce a potential cryptocurrency. We've also had Turkey. Realistically, any crypto state, nation state crypto can't exist in isolation because the finance comes from other crypto. So do you see nation state crypto as potentially a good thing to help the industry to grow or not?
I don't know if I think they'll affect the industry that much other than so here's the thing, like, I don't know if you listened to my episode with Catherine Hahn of DOJ. It's a super old one, so maybe you didn't, but she is a former prosecutor at the Department of Justice and now is a board member of Coinbase. And she's all in on crypto and blockchain. You know, she loves it. And of course, she's seen what criminals do with it. And I'm sure she knows that there are a lot of different types of bad actors who will do things with it. But she thinks the power of this technology to revolutionize our, you know, to prevent fraud, you know, as I mentioned with like birth certificates or you know, land titling or whatever. I think it's not just because she's seen what people can do with it that is bad. It doesn't make her any less bullish on the technology. So in that regard, like I feel like most likely those cryptocurrencies aren't going to take off, right? And if anything, maybe they will only highlight what the pitfalls are of having this more centralized version of a cryptocurrency. Actually, I just came out with an episode on stablecoins. And one of the questions I asked Rune Christensen of MakerDAO, who they're trying to do a stablecoin, I said, if a fiat version of a cryptocurrency comes out, like a dollar you know, crypto dollar, basically, then isn't that going to render your project moot? And he was like, oh, no, actually, because that's not decentralized. It's still a single point of failure. You know, they could debase the currency. They could do all these things. But with MakerDAO, like, it's not centralized. And I was like, oh, interesting point. Right. I hadn't thought of that, you know, because I thought his goal was to peg it to the dollar. But it's not really. He was like, we could change the value to, like, you know, base it on the cost of consumer goods or something like that. So, you know, I think it will be a similar thing where maybe as time goes on, people start to realize the value in a decentralized crypto, you know, something rather where the people control it and not some, you know, central actor like a government.
Right. And there is some disparity between how different governments have reacted to crypto. The US is quite pro at the moment. I think we all quite enjoyed the Senate testimony hearing. Christopher Giancarlo is our new hero.
Yeah.
At the same time, China's gone the opposite way and pretty much banning crypto. Do you see that China will have to change and become part of this? Do you have any opinions on that?
Oh, gosh.
It feels like they're cutting themselves out to a whole asset class and a whole part of the global economy.
I mean, you know, I don't know. Like, you know, apparently if you go to China, you cannot Google things and you can't access the New York Times or Facebook. So, the country is big enough that maybe it won't matter if they cut themselves off from this brand new crypto economy sprouting up. But, I mean, you know, in China, you know, all the Apple phones are sold out, like, immediately. And so there's still demand for American things. And so maybe there will just be pent-up demand for these crypto assets within China as well. I don't know. This is a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but I will say, like, you know, like I just said, that even though they've banned all these other things that have become huge, the company or the country functions just fine. Yet at the same time, we saw that, like, after they closed the crypto exchanges, then Binance, you know, got super, super popular really, really fast. And so I think, or like apparently in Korea, and those exchanges are seeing a lot of demand from Chinese people.
They're finding a way.
I think they are. And so who knows? Like, maybe people in China will get angry enough that there are these restrictions that something happens. I have no idea.
I really enjoyed the Senate testimony here. And it felt like it was something that was needed, in that we had a phase of growth through speculation. Then we had a phase of growth through institutional money coming in. And I feel like everyone was starting to get nervous, especially with ICOs, what would happen in terms of regulation. But it feels like the US approach has been support innovation within a regulatory framework. How do you feel about the testimony? Did you watch it?
Yeah. I think that they've been, like, pretty smart and cautious, somewhat measured. You definitely get the sense that they are grappling with a real issue here, which is, how do they fulfill their mission of protecting consumers at the same time, or protecting investors, or in the case of the CFTC, consumers, I think, or that's the FTC, but whatever. Anyway, I think that, you know, you see that they're grappling with these missions to protect Americans, and then at the same time, foster innovation, right? They, you know, they want to make sure they get the bad actors, but not do, like, for instance, what the New York State regulators did with the BitLicense, where now all these companies have left New York and there's...
Didn't the guy who set that up then set up a company to help people apply for the license?
Yes.
I can't remember his name, but I saw
Ben
that
Lockie.
In the... Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's no comment on that one, but... So I definitely don't envy the regulators their job in the US. You know, I've mentioned this before on other podcasts. It was actually a seminar I did for journalists who want to cover cryptocurrency. But, you know, the first couple of years when I covered this, it was really like a lot of learning about cool technology and just thinking about the future and, like, how our lives could change. And then last year, it was a lot of investigating shady people doing shady things. So that was a much less fun type of thing to do. But it was important for, you know, for what I was doing as a journalist. But the point is that, you know, I definitely can see, just even from my little point of view where the regulators would be somewhat alarmed by what's going on, especially in the ICO space. But, you know, I know that they've been educated by Coin Center and Chamber of Digital Commerce and, you know, these other groups that deal with regulators. And they, I think, really understand the technology, as we saw in that testimony. And so I think they're keenly well aware that whatever they do can have an impact either way. And so they want to be thoughtful about the way they're approaching it. And I think, as we saw with the Dow report, like, it's a pretty sensible line of thinking, at least so far. And it's one where they're using existing laws and they're not going out and doing things like the BitLicense and coming up with new stuff. They're like using the way the law has been applied for the last 70 years around these issues to bring them to bear on this space as well.
So if we rewind back to then 2015, when you were writing, we were essentially in a post MT Gox bear market, a very tiny global market cap, to today having a half a trillion. We nearly made a trillion. What was it like writing back in 2015? What kind of things were you covering which you aren't really covering today?
Well, now that I just do the podcast, at least for now, I'm really out of the news cycle. But back then I did a lot of, like, it was a lot more blockchain enterprise blockchain stuff. I remember one of my first articles, I wrote about Vinnie Langham's company Gift and how they were putting their gift cards on the blockchain and how there was so much fraud in gift cards and how they were losing all this money and how blockchains could resolve that problem. And then I, you know, that big magazine article was about Chain, which, you know, it ended up partnering with Visa and Citi and NASDAQ. And so, but what's funny is, like, that made such headlines at the time, but now, like, nobody cares about any of the enterprise blockchains. Like, they're basically pretty boring, you know? So, I mean, like, well, I don't know if I'd say maybe that was, like, a little bit extreme. I definitely think, you know, well, like, for instance, some of the enterprise blockchain stuff, I think that people could, I don't know if excited is the word, but where they can really see the value of it are, like, where a lot of Chinese consumers, I think, are concerned about the provenance of their food, like, you know, baby milk. That was an issue, the tainted baby milk, like, whatever that was, sometime in the last 5 or 10 years. And so I know that there's enterprise blockchain pilots working on stuff like that. It's not sexy, but it is something where, like, it would have a real impact on people, and, like, they would probably, you know, really appreciate that technology or even be interested to learn about it. But yeah, but by and large, like, most people are like Bitcoin, Ethereum, Zcash, Monero. I think those are kinds of the ones that are, like, some of the more quality projects that people talk about. And then, of course, you have all the other ones where they're talking about the crap coins and you're so excited about those. But
did you buy crypto early on?
I bought a little bit of Bitcoin and a little bit of Ether. So at Forbes, they let you do that as long as you disclose that you own. But now that I'm freelance, I realized I would probably need to sell it for if I want to write for other publications. And actually that opportunities come up faster than I expected. So I'm actually like selling or donating or something. I'm going to give them.
So you won't actually be a crypto owner?
No. What I'll probably end up having to do, though, is...
You'll be a no-coiner.
Well, what I'll probably have to end up doing is, for reporting purposes, my business maybe will buy just some amount that I can use for, you know, checking out new products and whatever. But yeah, like, I won't be able to just buy and hold, you know, for my own personal use later.
Can you remember how much Bitcoin was when you first bought it?
Oh, I don't want to reveal.
Okay. So then obviously things started to change about 2016. We all know last year went crazy, but when did you start it to notice a kind of tipping point changing everything?
In the summer of 2016, everybody started talking about app tokens. App coins. They were calling them app coins. And they were calling them things like Wall Street 2.0. And, like, it was kind of funny. It's just all the nomenclature, like, it's all changed.
Okay, so then looking back at the last 12 to 18 months, it's obviously been absolutely crazy. Have you got any perspective on what's happened? Can you actually take a step back and look down? And what do you think's going on? What are the things that really stand out for you and in the industry? And where do you think we're heading?
Well, one thing I would definitely say is that when I started in 2015, even I didn't really understand the power of Bitcoin. Like, I understood the technology, understood how powerful it was that you could send money, that it would make its way across the globe in 10 minutes, and that you would pay like almost nothing in fees, and that you would use software to do it, right? I understood that on a very basic level. But I remember just thinking to myself, well, that's all really cool, but you know, when I'm using my credit card, I feel like it's instantaneous and I don't notice the fees. So why should I use this, right? And I could get why, like, maybe people in developing countries would use it. But I just was like, I don't know if it's going to take off here. And I even remember interviewing somebody at Coinbase. And when I said, like, oh, you know, how is this going to take off? How are we going to get people to use it? They were like, oh, well, you know, we're setting up these merchants, and since they're paying less in fees to the credit cards, they can give a discount of 1% to the customers. And I was like, nobody's going to use this. Like, you know, it's just like, what kind of rationale is that? Like, I was like, you know, I just thought, oh, that's the most compelling thing they can tell me. Like, okay, forget this. Like, this probably isn't going to go anywhere. And because, you know, I saw that Visa and Citi and NASDAQ were getting in on it, I was like, oh, like, maybe what's going to happen is that the banks are going to use it to offer new products and services. Like, maybe that's the way things will go. But then, yeah, once I realized that all my sources were talking about AppCoins and that they were grappling with these questions of, like, are these securities? How do they shake out in terms of the law? You know, I began to realize, like, oh, this is going to be a big thing. And this is going to, you know, this is like a total shift in business models, right? Like, you know, traditionally you have a startup, you, have shares in it, you offer equity to your different investors. But you know, that model itself has even been changing already for a long time, in the sense that companies don't, they stay private for forever. And so, like, it's only really the private investors, the already wealthy investors, who are seeing benefiting from the growth in these companies, right? Whereas, like, you know, you have Uber now and Airbnb, that are these massive companies, they're not going public. So there is a lot of pent up demand, I think, in the market, and, you know, from non-accredited investors to be able to, you know, partake in the fruits of these new companies. And so here was a way where you could do it, not with a company, but with essentially, like, almost like offering a public utility. It's a really interesting concept, right? And then this, I mean, the one thing, so the foundation model, I think, like, it remains to be seen if that's going to be a good thing. You know, obviously it's, I think, worked at least, well, yeah, I was going to say it's worked well for Ethereum, but even then, like, I don't know if you could go that far, because there have definitely been issues with the Ethereum Foundation and the way that that's run. So I don't know, maybe that's going a little...
In that it's arguably centralized around Vitalik, is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think it started with like 4 or 5 members, and then it was just down to Ming and Vitalik for a while, but it was like not clear, and the website wasn't even like very... forthcoming on all the details. And, you know, you just after a while noticed that some of the members had left, or the board members had left, but it just, you know, the governance seemed sort of opaque. And then, like, you know, they randomly announced she was leaving, and then they brought in Aya, and but there was, you know, it doesn't appear that there was a super transparent process about how that shift occurred and how they chose Aya and questions like that. So granted, obviously, like, it appears to have been a smooth transition, but for, like I said, a public utility, like, it just feels like, oh, you know, here we have coming online this year, Tezos and Definity, and I think there are some others, like, people keep tweeting at me to check out Decred, and I'm sorry, Decred people, I have not checked out Decred yet, but yeah, you know, these are blockchains where people can you know, use their tokens to have a vote and how it's run. And that will obviously be a lot more transparent. So it is, yeah, it's not, I actually can't even remember what the original question was.
Well, I was asking you about, you know, with everything that's happened over the last 12 to 18 months, like, what was your kind of, like, if you can stand above and just look at everything that's happened, what do you make from it all? But interesting myself, you know, because I agree with you. When you say about spending, it is so much easier to buy something on your card than it is with crypto. Crypto is a bit of a pain. The exception to that is I'm a miner as well. So I have a mining rig in Washington, and I bought $240,000 of equipment from Bitmain. It was a 10-minute transaction with a $3 fee. So for me, the use case for that was outstanding, because trying to do that with the banks...
Wait, did you do that with Bitcoin Cash? Because they're only taking cash now?
Although they started to take credit cards for certain things. But in terms of a transaction, trying to do that through the banks would have been really, really difficult. But the kind of space I came to realize that I saw the power with Bitcoin and Ethereum is that with these tokenized economy, that actually Bitcoin and Ethereum almost act as the providing the liquidity and the settlement layer to these, which is where I saw the big opportunity was, which isn't something I saw in 2013 when it was just like, this is another currency. So I was kind of wondering from your perspective, if, you know, how do you see the crypto economy as a whole? You know, what's the role of Bitcoin within there, you know, from where you've been?
Oh gosh,
big question.
So, well, this actually maybe goes back to finishing up the answer about like how things changed in 2017. I think part of that big wave was just really seeing that people were really starting to grasp the capabilities of Ethereum. And, you know, this concept of app coins that people started talking about in 2016, I think that was where they kind of started understanding, like, oh, here's what you can do with this worldwide computer. And it's different from like just sending a payment. Like, I don't know if you read Fred Ursem's blog post where he said that Bitcoin is the equivalent of like a four function calculator and Ethereum's the equivalent of, you know, like a computer. I don't remember the exact analogy, but you know, he was basically saying like there's so many more things you can do, but it took people, I think, kind of a little while to figure that out. But, you know, last summer when we looked at the ICOs, like, there were so many ideas, like obviously so many of them are probably just not going to work out because it's like basically too early for them. But, you know, I imagine like some of those ideas, it'll be kind of like, what is it? Web van versus like Instacart, you know, it's like maybe 20 years from now, we will see something like some of these app coin projects from last, they even weren't even called app coins by the time of 2017. But you know, I guess they were called app tokens. Hmm. Were they called app?
Just
the ICOs
tokens.
ICOs that were like more consumer facing. But yeah, I wonder. So I feel like that flourishing that happened maybe was kind of like people starting to understand like the capabilities of Ethereum, or this concept of like creating a mini economy around some service or function. You know, when you ask me now kind of like what I think of the total crypto landscape, I would say that, you know, a lot of the tokens that have done well or that appear to be kind of on the more established level are ones that are functioning as pure money. You know, Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Litecoin, Dash, Monero, Zcash, like the ones that are kind of just more in the straight up money realm are maybe they have a little bit more traction right now. Because that's kind of like the first step, right? But, you know, Ethereum, so I'm not a developer, but apparently a lot of developers tell me that Ethereum is very easy to program on. And so, or to build stuff on. And so that's why we're seeing, you know, things like the DAO and CryptoKitties just like take off so fast on that platform. Like, you know, all the ICOs, of course. Or even like that stupid thing that happened like a few weeks ago, the Crypto All-Stars, you know, just like everything. I feel like on that platform, things happen super fast. But one thing that's interesting to me about that is from what I understand of the programming language, I think it's like one of those ones where, yeah, you can build something quickly, but can you build something that's like safe for a financial system? Like that's kind of a question where, you know, in terms of security and just being certain that the smart contract will perform the way that you want it to, like all those things are a little bit more up in up in the air about Ethereum. And so
I think I heard an interview with Ari Paul where he was saying the same. And actually, I think maybe it was somebody else, but was questioning whether Turing complete is actually good for financial systems, in that, you know, we've seen smart was it with Olaf Carson where you were discussing the smart contracts that were essentially deleted hundreds of millions in funds? Because, you know, could we realistically see any financial institution putting that kind of risk within their operations?
Oh, you mean like an enterprise?
Yeah.
I mean, they're all working on it. I mean, the financial institutions, I think, see the writing on the wall. Like, you know, I went to this dinner and I was seated next to this woman who works at JP Morgan Chase. I don't know if she knew what my position was in the ecosystem. I think she just, it was like a women in blockchain type of thing. But, you know, she was telling me like, oh, well, you know, when we really looked into the technology, we're like, oh man, this technology just completely replaces us. Like, it gives us nothing to do. Like, what are we going to do? And so she literally full on admitted that to me and was saying that like they needed to figure out a way to like retain their role, but use the technology. And so,
When was that? And how close to
November, I think.
Was Jamie Dimon, was that when he turned 10360 and said it was okay now?
No, he said that later, like in the winter. This was more like November, but I think what she was describing was conversations back in like 2015 or 2014, you know, like when they first started learning about the technology. So, yeah, I mean, it was just like a funny moment. Like, that's why, I don't know, I shouldn't be so dismissive of the enterprise blockchains, because like maybe they'll come up with something really cool. I don't know. But right now, you know, I feel like nobody cares about those. Everybody's excited about the public stuff.
What did you make of, you know, it seemed like Olaf was struggling with what the right decision was for creating a hard fork to recover funds, in that none of it was stolen. It was just deleted. I saw both sides of the argument. What was your position on that? Do you have a position on that?
I don't know. So for a lot of these things, I don't really have a position, but I can see it both ways. You know, obviously, so the argument on the side of the people who want to release the funds is that, you know, this was a mistake and it would be like relatively easy to fix. I think on the flip side, what the argument is that forgive me, because I actually don't know all the details around the proposal, but I think like at least part of the proposal, if not the whole proposal, is to create a function that allows anybody to do this for any mistake or something like that.
But blockchain should be immutable.
Right, exactly. So I don't know. I could see it either way, because it's like, if you want to unfreeze it, then like that stance is a little bit more like the way that our penal system works, where, you know, juveniles don't face the same penalty as adults. You know what I mean? And so you could say like, okay, this is like clearly a new system. We're still working out the kinks. We're not going to let this devolve into some slippery slope where no one can trust the platform, but this is such a huge sum of money. Like, and it was an honest mistake. Let's reverse it. But then I could see other people saying, no, we already learned that mistake with the DAO. Like, that was when a bigger percentage of the full funds of the Ethereum ecosystem were at risk. This is like a much smaller percentage. This isn't worth doing this over. And we need to make people serious about treating this like, you know, a true financial system, and not making these blockchains seem reversible. And also, if you do that, then but also maybe the regulators will be like, hey, you know, so and so got wronged by this transaction, can you undo it? And, you know, and so if you set some sort of precedent like that, that's dangerous. So I can see it both ways.
So it's interesting. I split the crypto assets down into sub assets. I see currencies, which I see the use case for, and they're being used as currencies, you know, whether you call it store wealth or medium exchange, I just group it together. I see the protocols, which sit above them, the tokens and the securities. And it feels like the currency essentially the case is proven in that you can spend it and people have given value to it. With the protocols and the tokens, there are, beyond CryptoKitties and Crypto All-Stars, there's very few examples of mass scale usage. Do you think there's a risk that there won't be a requirement for these systems, or do you think it's just a time issue?
Wait, I'm sorry, that there won't be a need for what systems?
Well, so will these protocols ever be able to deliver mass scale decentralized systems that can scale and work and be used? Do you see it as inevitable they will, or do you see...
Yeah, I'm not worried about that.
You're not worried about that at all?
I mean, like, I don't know. It's just, you know, if you look back in the early days of the internet, people were like, how can this scale? And, you know, it did. I feel like the technical issues like that don't worry me as much as kind of the stickier issues, or like, you know, things like governance or, I mean, obviously I'm sure there's going to be interesting challenges when it comes to scaling, but it's not something I spend a ton of time thinking about, other than as, you know, an aspect of the different horse races that are going on between the various currencies and protocols. So, but one thing I would amend in your statement is, I feel like Ethereum is something that we can say has taken off, right? Like, I mean, if you look at the ICO craze from last year, the DAO the year before, the CryptoKitties at the end of 2017, like, so, you know, some of the major stuff going on in the ecosystem, it's all come out of Ethereum, and it's every single time it's come out super, super fast. So I think it just shows, like, when you do have this kind of like worldwide platform that anybody anywhere can build on, like, people are going to do that. And the people who are going to engage with that, they're also worldwide. And so just, you know, the speed at which these things can take off and the ways in which they can get people all over the globe, I think it's pretty powerful.
I guess the challenge I found is that CryptoKitties highlighted scaling issues with Ethereum as a single application. Once we have hundreds of global applications being used, you know, we don't know how or if they can achieve the scaling. It's kind of an unknown, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of the things that worried me. And also with the ICOs, you mentioned the ICOs. The ICO model is proven as a really great way to raise money. But you're not a fan, right?
I mean, like, you know, I think everybody's tired of ICOs, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that I'm not a fan, but
you're not
what
a fan
I would say,
of the scams and the...
I'm not a fan of the scams. I'm not a fan of the poorly designed ICOs. I'm not a fan of ICOs where there's only, you know, like a small number of buyers. I'm not a fan of the pre-sales. You know, I think it should, you know, if you're going to use this technology, then take advantage of kind of the unique benefits that it offers, where you can really democratize things. And instead, I feel like oftentimes people are using it to just give really extreme discounts to already wealthy people. And it's like, well, why? You know, I mean, they're already wealthy. They don't need more money. And you have this technology that can make it fair for everyone. And so everyone who participates gets the same price. And then, like, you're really seeding a network. And then it is, you know, I mean, there are certain sales where they did try their best to even prevent Sybil attacks and, you know, make sure there really was only one account per person. And so every single person that participated got the same number of tokens and things like that. And, you know, I really applaud those projects. I know that it was a lot of work for them to try to prevent people from gaming the system. But yeah, it's interesting because, like, you can never design just like one standard sale that will always prevent people from gaming the system, because once they figure out what the rules are for that, then they will figure out how to game it. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, yeah, in general, what I would say about the ICOs is that, it's something where it's so easy to just make money from everyday mom and pop people. And so what I don't like about the fact that it is that easy is that then you've got the unscrupulous people who don't care about taking money from everyday people and just like spending it to buy Lamborghinis or whatever, rushing into that system. You know, for the people who really want to build something, I think it definitely, depending on what they're trying to build, it can be the right model for them to raise money. And so, you know, I don't kind of begrudge them that opportunity. And especially, you know, as, I mean, like my sister's an entrepreneur, you know, and I know how hard it is for female entrepreneurs to raise money from venture capitalists, right? So like, I applaud anything where it might give people like that who, you know, don't necessarily look like the typical entrepreneur a chance to say, hey, I've got like a really good, you know, product here. Do you want to pitch in? Like, I like the idea of that model, but the way that it's played out in real life, I don't know if I'm a big fan of.
It seems that we're moving to a stage where the pre-sales are going mainly to institutional money now, and that the retail investors are being edged out. Have you noticed this?
Yeah. So I'm just going to argue against what I just said for a little bit, because I can see it both ways.
It de-risks it, right? For the...
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you read Marco Santori and Protocol Labs' white paper, but about the SAFT, but, you know, they talk about how basically when you're funding something in the very early stages, it's, you know, much more similar to like seed investing or angel investing, and how that level of risk where, you know, something may really not pan out and you might just like lose a bunch of money, that risk really should be borne by people who are already wealthy and who have the money to lose. So I can totally see that perspective, and I understand why those projects are maybe going that route. And for that reason, I can also apply the way that they're doing that to say like, hey, in case this doesn't pan out, at least we haven't lost the money of everyday mom and pop investors. Right. And the other reason why I applaud that is because then they're less likely to run up against regulatory issues that could also put the projects or the money of their investors at risk. However, it's weird because it's just like when you put like the word ICO on something, then like suddenly it's like the VCs lose their minds, right? Like,
yeah.
How could you do a quote unquote pre-sale for $850 million and it's like 20 some investors? I don't even know what the numbers were, but
are you talking about Telegram?
Yeah. Like,
are they looking to raise, was it 1.7 billion in total?
Yeah. Yeah. Then they were going to like do another round, and it's like, like this, like, it just makes no sense. Like, why would they need all, like, maybe, I don't know. I did not look into it closely. Maybe if I really did a deep dive, I'd be like, oh, okay, this is the reasoning. And like,
I saw the same argument with EOS though. Why are they running a year long ICO and raising $1 billion? But I also saw a counter argument that said, well, once the platform's ready, they're going to have a significant war chest to pay developers to come and develop with on their platform.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those, like, it's almost difficult for me to criticize things because I can think of the criticism, but then I can think of like, you know, the way that you would defend against that criticism. And I mean, it really just depends on like what your priorities are. You know, obviously you can find sources who will take some particular rationale and like tear it to pieces. And then I can find others who I also think are smart, who will be like, oh, well, actually, you know, if you have this other set of priorities, then actually the way they're going about it is good. So, yeah, it's one of those things where obviously nobody knows what they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone's just making it up as they go along. And so when they do that, then whatever they decide to do, they're trying to justify. And that's the situation we're in. And it's only like after a few years from now where we'll see kind of what all the pitfalls were, the different methods, and which kind of like ended up being the one where the trade-offs were ones that were acceptable to the most people.
I mean, I see your seed round argument. I guess the difference being is when you invest in a seed round, you don't have a market to trade your seed round shares on immediately for
right,
20x.
Right.
And I guess...
And dump everyone, them on everyday people.
Yeah. And people want to get in early because that's where the significant growth is, you know. And,
right.
And by the time, you know, these products start hitting the market, which could be next year when we start seeing a wave of products come in, the valuations could drop heavily. So it feels like Wall Street can get in early and make the big returns while we're in the speculation phase.
Yeah.
So I see your argument on that. Okay. Also, look, there is, I think, one big issue we have in crypto and isn't just the scams, but it is the hacks. There's a lot of shady sides to crypto, which mainstream media seems to pick on and use to attack. Actually, that's a separate point. I was going to ask this earlier. Have you noticed a lack of understanding in mainstream media, in your CNBCs? I'm not sure if you want to answer that.
I mean, what I'll say is my criticism of some of the media in this space is that sometimes I watch some of the coverage or read or whatever, and I just worry to myself, like, oh my God, is this outlet single-handedly trying to create the bubble? Like, I get a little bit freaked out. You know, some of them don't have kind of a level of nuance that I would like to see. Or they kind of stoke this FOMO feeling. And so, you know, like, oh my God, the price of such and such has risen, blah, blah, blah. And it just, yeah, I mean, I don't.
Okay, I'm conscious of time, so I'm going to look to wrap it up. Just talk a bit about the future. I'm going to ask a bit about the crypto future, but I also just want to focus a little bit on you, because thank you for giving me your time. So where do you think we go over the next year with crypto? And do you have any kind of picture of where we might be in like 5 years' time?
Oh my gosh. That's a tough question.
Yeah.
So this year is probably like a little bit easier of an answer to give. I think there's so much talk about decentralized exchanges, and we're already seeing that there's some activity in that regard. And then also stablecoins, I think, are a big topic this year. So those are kind of like two trends that I feel like they'll become probably bigger as the year goes on. I'm not sure what the full implications of that will be. It may, you know, frankly, I'm actually supposed to do an interview on decentralized exchanges in the next few days, and so I haven't finished my research on that, so I don't have like a super big opinion on it at the moment, but
I worry about liquidity with them.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering about the regulatory issues. That's kind of an interesting thing. But yeah, so we'll see kind of what happens with both of those. In that episode I just released on stablecoins, I really started to grasp like just how powerful they could be. And so if one of them takes off, like that might be a really interesting experiment to watch, especially because so many predict that certain ones structured certain ways will definitely fail. So yeah, there could be like some fantastic stories in there. But then for 5 years, I would say like maybe we'll have gone through probably like because I think, so we're in a bubble, but I think it hasn't really burst yet. So
do you think bubbles are a bad thing? In that I've seen the counter argument that bubbles drive innovation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, like everything in life, there's like an upside and a downside.
Yeah.
Out of the speculation we get, capital being brought in to drive this innovation. But of course when the bubble pops, there will be people who will be hurt. So, yeah, it's just one of those things that's not black and white, but, what I was going to say, about 5 years from now. So I think we'll have been through a boom bust cycle. There will be a lot more regulatory clarity. And I think certain of these kind of more infrastructure-based economies might really be thriving. So, but they might be like more in the background type things. So, things like the Filecoin type or just any of these storage tokens or, something like Gollum where you're renting out computer cycles, like maybe stuff like that, where it might be more kind of like small companies that are doing it, it could be everyday people too, but, I wonder if maybe that stuff will be a little bit more solidified. And then, I do expect that we will see like certain smart contract platforms really emerge as the winners, and it might be more than one. Obviously Ethereum has a big lead start, but, you know, there are a lot of issues around, the security, the governance. And so Ethereum may not be the ultimate winner. And so that's why, some of the other smart contract platforms that are coming out like Tezos and Definity that have a lot of buzz, I'm definitely keeping an eye on those because, I really think I think no matter what, we are going to see a major, major smart contract platform, potentially more than one, just kind of like take the lead and really dominate and have a ton of stuff built on it. So I would imagine maybe like within 5 years, we might sort of get a sense of which one or ones that might be.
Okay. And then what about the future for you? You have your new podcast out. You've done two episodes, right?
Yeah.
So what's the future for you that you can reveal?
So the major thing I would just say is that I am kind of emphasizing the podcast, at least for now, more the writing that I'm doing is stuff I don't want to talk about too much, that I am continuing to write. And I want people to know that you are not going to completely, you know, not see me write at all anymore. There definitely will be new material. It's just not certain exactly what format it will take or where it will go, but there will be, there's already a couple freelance articles I'm working on. Those are ones I have to sell my coins for. So those will be coming up, but that won't be for, well, I don't know when you're publishing this, but it won't be until like, at least 6 weeks from now, I think.
And if people want to reach out to you, how should they get in touch?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter, which is at Laura Shin, S-H-I-N.
Do you use earn.com?
Earn.com. Oh yeah, I do, but not really. Like I used to keep my Twitter DMs open, but you know, I just get like an insane number of messages all the time. Like it's out of control. And now that I'm not doing everyday news, I kind of was like, oh man, this is taking so much time away from everything else that I'm trying to do. So I set up an earn.com platform, a page, but then I like never check it. So every once in a while I'll check in and be like, oh my God, there's so many people that want me to like respond to these messages.
You've got $20 waiting from me.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. So I'm sorry.
I went there, then LinkedIn.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah. I checked the LinkedIn a little bit more actually. Oh shoot. I shouldn't have said that. But anyway, no, I mean, yeah, people find me on like LinkedIn. They find me, sometimes they get my personal email address. Like there's like, yeah. And I get too many messages, you know, so I can't, I'm sorry if you messaged me because I cannot respond to every single message. I just cannot. I will never, ever get anything done if I do that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I've just started to experience that just on probably on a much smaller scale than you. Just started to get a lot of DMs on Twitter, some really strange ones. And, I understand that. Okay. Look, I want to say just a big thank you for this. And, just a big thank you for everything you've done for blockchain and crypto.
Oh, thanks.
I think you've, this was a really challenging interview for me in that I feel like I'm like a book on crypto and you're like an encyclopedia. So
oh,
I feel
no,
like
I
I'm,
would not say that at all. No way. I'm still learning every single day.
That's one of the challenges that I write. There is, you know, you step in the rabbit hole and there's just layers upon layers of things to learn. And you know, that could be a whole nother conversation. But I just want to say thank you from me and just thank you for everything you've done in for blockchain and crypto.
Oh, thanks.
And hopefully we'll do this again one day.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks.
So how was that? Did you enjoy it? Did I hold my own against Laura? I think I pretty much got through it. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking to Laura. I think from that, I learned a lot about how to prepare for an interview. And I definitely think in future I will be doing a lot more work based on what she does. She seems to be fully embedded in the space, consuming knowledge constantly. But, you know, she was brilliant. And yeah, like I say, she answered a whole bunch of questions for me before we started recording that really can help with my podcast. So I'm massively grateful to her for that. As I mentioned before, she has two podcasts. I recommend you check both of them out, Unchained and Unconfirmed. Unchained is the main one that she's been recording for a while with a long interview similar to probably mine, but the other one, Unconfirmed, is like a weekly show where she interviews people about what's been going on in the blockchain space. So definitely check them out and check out the interview with Naval Ravikant, which I mentioned in the intro, which is really, really cool. So listen, as I said before, please support the show, please leave us a review on iTunes, come and follow me on social media. If you've got any questions, give me a shout. I'll do everything I can to get back to you as quickly as possible. Outside of that, have a great rest of your week.